All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses in the government and commercial or corporate marketplace. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to nvbdc.org. We also want to thank Eisenhower Center. It's a brain injury recovery center, and in particular, it's after the impact program goes beyond awareness campaigns and state-of-the-art imaging to help veterans, first responders, and athletes. Learn more about EisenhowerCenter.com. They're located in Michigan and in Florida. And finally, we want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. And finally, we want to welcome a new sponsor to the program, which is Veterans Business Outreach Center, which is located in Flint, Michigan, and covers Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana. The center is ran and operated by veterans to help other veterans, National Guard, Reserve, spouses, expand and grow businesses. You can find more about them by going to vetbizcentral.org, 810-252-6200. And now on to our programs. We're going to talk to a couple of real warriors today. We're going to talk to Staff Sergeant Nick Bradley, who was injured in a IED explosion in 2008, but he has a great story of positive attitude and redemption that you need to hear. And we're also going to talk to Andy Kubik, who is a air combat controller with the United States Air Force. Again, one of those stories that you make movies out of. So settle back in and listen to both of these gentlemen talk about their service and their patriotism. This is what Veteran Radio does best. We tell the stories of veterans. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Nick Bradley. Nick is an Air Force veteran, has quite a story that we want to get out to our Veteran Radio listeners. Nick, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thanks for having me, Jim. I really appreciate it.
Well, we certainly want to talk about your military experiences, some of the hardships that and the struggles that came out of that, but also the lessons you've learned and things that has sort of surprised you over the last decade or 10 years or so. But let's start with this. You joined the United States Air Force in 2001. Why the Air Force? Why at that time?
So it's kind of a funny story, actually. So the night I graduated high school, my dad sat me down and, you know, we were just kind of weighing out some of my options, you know, what the future held for me. And he essentially told me, son, I love you, but you have 30 days to get out of my house. And so, you know, when you put it in perspective like that, I mean, it's, you got to figure out what you want to do real fast. And, you know, for an 18-year-old kid, that was a little scary. And I had been meeting with a Marine Corps recruiter, and my best friend had already left for boot camp, and he sends me a letter, and he's like, Nick, don't join the Marines, join the Air Force. I hear it's way better. And so it's kind of funny how it all worked out, because he's still an active duty Marines. But that day, after I got his letter, I went over and I talked to the Air Force recruiter, and decided I really liked what he said, and the rest was kind of history. I signed up that day. It was June 25th, 2001. When I enlisted in the United States Air Force.
And you had, obviously, some additional training over the next couple of years. You were stationed in, I think, at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. What was your MOS? What were you being trained up for?
So I was a security forces operator. My primary role, they do security and law enforcement. It's kind of like an MP, if you will. But the way the Air Force does it, it's a little different than the other branches, because the security forces, it's three or four different MOSs combined into one. So that's kind of where I jumped in. Now, what really helped me out at the time, a lot of guys were enlisting for 6 years. Well, I only enlisted for four, so I came in with no stripes. I'm what they call it, the slick sleeve. So I had, you know, it took me a while to put all those stripes on. So by the time I caught up to everybody, my resume at that point was extremely extensive, which afforded me a lot of opportunities to go to like a lot of specialized trainings and things of that nature. For instance, I went out to Nellis Air Force Base and flew drones. I got certifications to do that and, you know, things of that nature. So I got to do some kind of cool odds and ends outside of the scope of the normal MOS.
So naturally, anybody at that point in time who's been in for some couple of years, 3 or 4 years, you finally find yourself with some orders for deploying overseas. Tell us about your first deployment.
So my first tour overseas, it was in 2003. So it was at the end of 2003. So the war had kicked off earlier in 2003. And so I was going at the end. And we were originally slotted for Kuwait. We got there and we got forwarded a couple weeks in. So we were doing detainee operations out of Camp Buka, which is South Iraq. So we were essentially, we just do what we call flyaway missions, and we'd fly out, you know, pick up some bad guys, bring them back, process them through, and then fly home for the day.
Now, as you said, you only joined up for 4 years, so 2005 rolls around, and it's, you know, time for you to either reenlist or get out. What was your thinking?
Well, you know, kind of just weighing the options. I really enjoyed what I was doing. I really, you know, more than that, I loved the people that I was working with. And, you know, I was just at a good spot in life, and I didn't really want to mess that up, so to speak. You know, I didn't want to cause any waves, really. And, you know, and I did. I had a passion to be in and serve, and I love putting that uniform on every day. So it wasn't too strenuous for me to say, hey, I'm going to raise my right hand and do it all again. At that point, I had made my mind up. I was going to do 20 years. I was going to be a lifer. So.
So
it's
you
an easy decision.
Well, and that's great. You reenlist, and they say, well, we've got just the nice garden spot to send you off to. Where do they send you in 2005?
So in 2005, I actually got orders. I was attached to the Army's 3rd Infantry Division out of Balad, Iraq, which was about 40 minutes north of Baghdad. And from there, I was attached to the Army's 3rd Infantry Division, and I was sent over primarily to fly drones for them. Essentially, what I would do is I would go out and I would fly the routes that the convoys were going to be running that evening. I would go ahead and fly the route just to make any notes. Hey, there's, you know, this route's obstructed with this vehicle, or keep an eye out for this, things of that nature. You know, just trying to give our guys the best advantage we could. And I mean, that was my primary job. Now, if I wasn't flying for them, since I was the lone Air Force guy there, I would usually end up in the turret of the Humvee on a raid or on a convoy, which wasn't the most desired position in the convoy. But it builds character, they say.
Those Army guys know you can't shoot straight in the Air Force. I can't even believe they'd let you do that.
Well, you know, it's funny. Well, I'm a country boy from Arkansas, so I grew up shooting my whole life. So I think that might have been part of it, is they knew that and took full advantage.
Well, you actually had a pretty high tempo in Iraq in 2005 on the number of surveillance missions that you flew for the convoys. Can you give us some sense of that tempo?
So it was a very high ops tempo. 05 was a little chaotic in Iraq. At the time we were there, we were averaging, you know, 6+ mortar attacks on the base a day. I mean, it was super, super high ops tempo. Now, you know, we had a little team there, and I mean, I was running 24 hours a day, depending on when convoys were going out, when missions were launching, things of that nature, because I always had to run the routes for them, and sometimes I would fly the drone with them. Let's say I'm not in the convoy, I would actually fly the drone, and it'd be above head as they're driving the route. So I would have direct comms with, you know, the truck commanders, and all parties actually involved in the convoy. So it was super high ops. So I think if I'm not mistaken, it was 188 sorties.
Yeah, that helps people who may be listening to Veterans Radio who don't have a sense of just sort of what the tempo is. And we're talking to Staff Sergeant Nick Bradley, a good old boy from Arkansas, as he explains himself as, who re-enlisted and they sent him off to Iraq. But that wasn't, you know, okay, that's fine. You got through that. You come back and do some more training in the U.S., and then you get the call to go off to Afghanistan. Tell us about that tour.
But what we were doing over there, we were sent over, it was a special duty. We were part of a protective service detail. We called us PSD is what it was, and we were part of a Bravo team, and we were sent over to guard an Army general. We were part of his security detail. So wherever he went, we would clear the routes. We'd send out advance teams. You know, essentially they'd go out, you know, an hour ahead of time just to make sure everything was set up for him. And they'd take out the bomb dogs and, you know, just kind of secure the scene where we were going to be at. And that was my primary role in Afghanistan.
And Nick, would this include clearing those routes again, flying drones over, running convoys to make sure they clear sort of the whole gambit of what it takes to clear a route?
Right. I mean, it is. It's everything encompassed in it. You're flying drones. You're getting the bird's eye view of everything. Then you also you've got to have the boots on the ground to really just, you know, see everything that's going on with a little bit better perspective. And so for instance, we send out an advance team. It's always an hour before the boss or the general would move. And so we'd run out, you know, say he's going to visit the president of Afghanistan. At the time it was Karzai. So we're going over to his palace. So we're checking with the gate guards just to make sure they know to open the gates. Don't stop them. Don't hold them up. Cause you don't ever want to have a sit and duck situation.
And this this goes on for four months or so until August 3rd of 2008, when you were on a protective service mission, and at that point the vehicle that you're in is struck by a 20-pound anti-tank mine IED. Again, a normal protective security detail that morning until it wasn't, right?
Correct. It was just a normal day. We went out, turned off on this dirt road, and they called out there was a culvert ahead. It's a perfect spot for an ID. We need to pick up pace. About that time, there was 100 meters away, there was two members of the Taliban that remotely detonated a 20-pound anti-tank mine It hit right underneath the gear shift of the vehicle I was operating. I was driving a Toyota Land Cruiser, so just your standard SUV. Because when you're doing a protective service detail, you want to blend in with the local populace, or at least that's what the general wanted. So, we weren't in a Humvee or we weren't in any type of military vehicle with armor. But the explosion ripped up under the gear shift of the truck. It crushed every bone in my face, every bone in my right arm and hand. My right hip was fractured. My knee was crushed. My right shin was fractured and my right foot was crushed as well. But I stayed in the vehicle through the explosion. Once the vehicle came to rest, it came to rest on the culvert actually. And then I fell out of the vehicle face first 9 feet straight down into the culvert. Now what's to really just make matters more exciting, if you will. When you're doing a protective service detail, it's not like when I was in Iraq and, you know, if you receive fire from the enemy, you get to get out of your vehicle. You get to return fire. You can engage the enemy. Whereas when we're doing a protective service detail, that's not what you do. You're not a get out and fight for force. So my team actually had to get the general back to the base, right? Get him to safety. And that's when they came back for me. So for 10 minutes, I laid in that ditch conscious by myself, just, you know, trying to, well, there's a lot of things running through your mind at that point, but you know, I was trying to get up and I couldn't. I was trying to grab my weapon to defend myself. Couldn't do that. I couldn't click the radio. The radio was busted. And at the time I was blind due to all the facial fractures. So it was, I can definitely say it was a low point in my life. Playing in that ditch.
And you're there alone, all busted up. You know, you know in your mind that they've had to run the general back, and all you can hope for is somebody gets back to you in time. And fortunately, somebody did. I always, in these discussions, and we're talking to Staff Sergeant Nick Bradley, who was severely injured in 2008 in Afghanistan by an IED. Nick, I always like to give some credit to the men who come back. And can you tell us a little bit about Garrett Knight and, you know, the guy who came back?
Yeah, I love talking about Garrett. He hates it, you know, which is why I do it. Just I really like to push his buttons.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, so Garrett, he's still active duty. He's an E-8 now, which is a senior master sergeant in the Air Force. But Sergeant Knight, he was actually the vehicle in front of me. He was driving the vehicle that had the dignitary inside the vehicle. He had to take him back, and then he rapidly made it back to me as fast as he could. He drove back on a couple of flat tires even. And, you know, it sounds kind of silly, you know, at times. But, you know, when I heard his voice, I just remember an instant calm just taking over, you know, my whole body. It's just, I can breathe now because my team's here. And, you know, he jumped in the ditch with me. He started bandaging me up, called in for the medevac, you know, pop smoke. So, you know, the Black Hawk knew where to land. But he went a step further. He actually stayed with me. So I flew from there. They flew me 55 minutes away to Bagram Airfield, which is where they did my first surgery. It was a 12-hour operation. They just kind of got my body ready for transport due to all the fractures. Garrett stayed with me through that surgery. And then when I flew to Germany, Launchtal, Germany, he actually flew with me to Germany just in case I woke up, which I didn't. But he stayed by my side the whole time. There's a lot to be said about a guy that'll do that. You know,
absolutely. And again, I think so few people serve nowadays, it's hard to understand the bond that's there and that, you know, what your buddy is going to do for you in the foxhole, if you will.
Right.
He stays with you to Germany. You end up being transported back to Walter Reed Army Medical Center. I think I saw that you had a total of something like 16 surgeries to try to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And I can only imagine that the recovery was as painful and as frustrating as anything you've ever been through in your life.
It was. You go from being able to run, you know, 5 miles every day because you're forced to, not because I chose to, but because I had to. But you go from doing that till now all of a sudden you can't sit up in a bed by yourself. You can't feed yourself. You know, you can't use the restroom by yourself. It's quite humbling, to say the least. That's an oversimplification. And then you sprinkle in all the pain and, you know, that goes along with that. It was very challenging, to say the least. You know, I remember when they brought me out of they had medically induced me into a coma. When they brought me out of the coma, they told me that they were having a hard time getting the nerves in my legs to respond. So my legs weren't working that well, and they were afraid that I might not be able to walk again. They told me I was looking at a minimum of 18 months at the hospital in Walter Reed in recovery. And, you know, to wake up to that news and then you look down and both your hands now have amputations on them and they're wrapped up. You can't really use them. You can't sit up. It's, that's like another getting hit with another bomb, so to speak.
Well, and I think everybody goes, you know, nobody has the struggles you had, but everybody goes through some struggles in their life, maybe not of this depth and quality and weight. But what I want to transition to is, hey, I don't want anybody out there thinking that Nick Bradley doesn't have it pretty good at the moment. And I don't think you want anybody thinking that. You've gone on. You know, there's been romance. There's been kids. There's been talk about the last, you know, I guess I said, broadly speaking, 10 years, although this is a concentrated, devastating period of life, you found a way to really make something out of that, haven't you?
I did. You know, I got down a little bit while I was still in Walter Reed, and then I just, you know, I really started to put things in perspective. And 2 months later, I walked out of that hospital on my own 2 feet. So just kind of defied everything they told me, and I decided not to stop there. Went back to school, finished my degree there, started playing golf. Really, really got into golf. It's borderline unhealthy, which I like to golf. But it's funny. I got selected to play in George Bush's Wounded Warrior golf tournament. And, you know, by random draw, this young man was my caddy. And then, you know, we hit it off. I got to know him and his family really well. And then his daughter graduated college and we hit it off. And we're about to celebrate 5 years of marriage. We have two beautiful daughters. So, you know, life has been good to me. I've had 19 surgeries to date now. So I've had to have a few extra ones. A couple years ago, I was golfing and the plate in my arm, it broke. And that was a whole ordeal. But, you know, they're still trying to keep me put together.
Well, and I wanted to back you up to sports because one of the things in reading your story and understanding you, and we have a mutual friend who says, hey, you got to talk to Nick. He's incredible. Sports has played a real role in your recovery as I look at it. Do you have that same sense?
Agreed, 100%. You know, and I use sports, but, you know, anything – that'll get you up and going. Something that'll wake you up in the morning and say, hey, I get to do this today and I'm going to do this. No matter how poorly I do it, I'm still going to get to do it. And whether I, you know, because that's the thing is I had to remind myself that I'm not 18 and young and can do everything, and, you know, sort of thing. But sports, it was so vital to my recovery.
It got you out and it got you competitive, didn't it?
It did. It did. That's exactly what it did, and which I think was needed because I, deep down, I'm a competitive person at everything we do. I mean, if me and my wife are playing rummy at home, I want to win. You know, it just I want to win at everything I do. And, you know, but that it was so awesome to just to get to go out and, you know, play just to play a game, just to play.
Well, you not only have a as you referred to, an unhealthy addiction to golf, you have become a player on the national team for amputee softball team. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Yeah. So back in 2015, I grew up playing baseball my whole life. Baseball was my favorite sport. I loved it so much. And, you know, I went out to do a pickup game with a church league, and I was like, hey, physically, I can actually still do this.
Well, and it's interesting in a team sport, golf's sort of a singular sport, right?
Right.
When you're playing softball at this level with other guys, it's a team sport. You're in the uniform. You got that team camaraderie. Man, that sounds like a lot of what you have in the military, doesn't it?
It's exactly the way I looked at it. Every time I got to step on the field with these guys, learned to value is just the way I perceive things. You know, it's just looking at things in a different light.
And that's really about how you perceive it as compared to letting somebody else put all that negativity on you.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, we really appreciate you taking some time to talk to Veterans Radio today, Staff Sergeant Nick Bradley. We are thrilled about how life is going for you, and that you know, there's so much positivity looking forward. And certainly as you get out there and talk to more folks, and as you get out there and play some more golf, keep doing what you're doing, because everything you're doing seems to be working.
Yes, sir, I will. And Jim, thanks for having me. It's been a blast talking to you.
As you can see, Nick Bradley is a hell of a guy, and we've got another hell of a guy coming up in Andy Kubik. You'll want to stick around after the break to hear his amazing story. So hang around for more Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Navy Captain John Cromwell gave his life to preserve the security of his mission. Details after this. Cromwell was aboard the USS Sculpin during the 9th war patrol of that vessel in enemy-controlled waters off Truk Island. Undertaking this patrol prior to the launching of our first large-scale offensive in the Pacific, Captain Cromwell possessed secret intelligence information of our submarine strategy and tactics, scheduled fleet movements, and specific attack plans. Constantly vigilant and precise in carrying out his secret orders, he moved his undersea flotilla forward despite savage opposition and established a line of submarines to southeastward of the main Japanese stronghold at Truk. Cool and undaunted as the submarine, rocked and battered by Japanese depth charges, sustained terrific battle damage and sank to an excessive depth, he authorized the Sculpin to surface and engage the enemy in a gunfight, thereby providing an opportunity for the crew to abandon ship. Determined to sacrifice himself rather than risk capture and subsequent danger of revealing plans under Japanese torture or use of drugs, Cromwell stoically remained aboard the mortally wounded vessel as she plunged to her death. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Welcome back to Veterans Radio. You're going to hear the story of Andy Kubik, who spent 15 years in the United States Air Force and Special Operations. He did tours in Bosnia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. He had 6 overseas deployments as a combat controller and rescue man, and it took a toll on him and his family. But it's a great story of what these men and women go through, and as importantly, how after all of that, people stick with them and they bounce back. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today U.S. Air Force veteran Andy Kubik. Andy, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much, Jim. Good to be here.
Well, it's always a pleasure to speak to somebody with such distinguished service, and a Michigan boy nonetheless. You grew up in Harbor Beach, which for those who don't know is over on Lake Huron in Michigan. Andy, you joined the Air Force right out of high school, I assume. What put you into that direction?
I wanted to join the military, and I knew I was eventually going to go to college sometime down the road. But my initial thought was, I need to get out there and not just see the world, but do some of the hardest work out there. You know, I was introduced to this by, do you remember Tom Clancy?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Quite a writer, quite a novelist.
Yep. I read all his books, and I knew I was going to be just like, I just forgot the name. But either way, there was two characters, Jack Ryan, who was a CIA analyst, and it's not Kyle, but it's a former Navy SEAL who worked with Jack Ryan. I wanted to be both of them. And I took off, found out about the Air Force, and learned that they had special operations, and that's what I wanted to do. I was set. And I would meet other kids who were just like me. They may have played football or baseball, and they didn't want to go to college, but they wanted to do something hard, and they had heard a word about special operations, and you know, you eventually would get surrounded by them.
Well, it's an elite group, and let me frame this a little bit for our veteran radio listeners. Andy served from 1990 through about 2004, about 15 years of service in the United States Air Force. He was in special operations, a combat controller, and saw activity, saw the battlefield in Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan throughout his 15-year career. And Andy's activities in Bosnia in 1999, when he was involved in rescuing a downed pilot, that same year he was named the United States Air Force Special Operations Command NCO of the Year. Anybody who's ever been in service knows, you know, if you achieve that kind of recognition, you had one hell of a year. And you indeed had one hell of a year. But why don't you tell folks about what being a Special Operations Command operator in the Air Force is about? I think a lot of people simply just didn't even know that the Air Force had such a group.
Sure. Everybody knows Navy SEALs, Army Special Forces, Rangers, Marine Recon. The Air Force comes in and has their own specialties to work with those teams. And they specialize in air power and rescue. So they produce combat controllers who are air traffic controllers and forward air controllers. That means they know how to control up to 30 aircraft at a time or more. And they can fight with airplanes, if that's a way to explain it. And then rescue specialists known as pararescuemen, who specialize in going behind enemy lines and rescuing downed pilots shot down behind enemy lines, and or fighting alongside other special operations and going in on a stack, clearing a building. They'll be right there amongst the team, and if one of them goes down, he'll pull away from the stack and immediately work on the individual or get him out. He'll rescue them. That's what it is to be an Air Force Special Ops or Special Warfare. And there's also air crew and pilots who fly especially modified aircraft like MC-130s, AC-130s. Used to have the Pavlo helicopter. They still have the Pavehawk helicopter. They have the Osprey. Any kind of specialized aircraft to get special warfare personnel in and out of the battlefield.
Andy, I don't know that you would know this number, but maybe you will. How many, put some context around this. How many combat controllers or special operation command folks are in the United States Air Force?
When I was in, there was 400. Now there's possibly 600.
It's still a pretty small contingent of men, and I assume some women nowadays.
We're trying, but there's no women.
And is that because none have gone through the qualifications, or are they precluded from these particular slots now?
It's we fully support them. It's none of them have passed.
this Forward Air Command, you say you fight with planes, is one way to frame it. And I think some of us maybe have seen this in the movies or read about it in what happened in Afghanistan. But it's that air combat controller who's on the ground marking targets for the airframes to come in and deliver their loads, right?
Yes. Yep. For fighter, bomber, and intelligence aircraft.
I suspect the guy on the ground is there pretty much in a stealth mode by himself. Tell us what a typical mission might look like in that role that you played.
Okay, take the deployment at 9/11. We were doing unconventional warfare with Army Special Forces and Afghan Native tribes. Unconventional warfare is when special warfare personnel align themselves with tribal foreign forces and they teach them how to fight. Then they go in and they fight alongside these native tribes. It was, it came to the public's eye in Vietnam, and it wasn't really until 9/11 that they really had equal action doing it for real. I was an example of a combat controller aligned with the Army Special Forces team. At 9/11, we had eight of us, eight combat controllers with eight different teams go in into Afghanistan, and we fought alongside the special forces and tribal forces. We snuck in by helicopter, and the tribal forces had Toyota pickup trucks for us, or some of them had horses, and we rode with them. We rode a couple hundred miles for the city of Kandahar. That was our objective, to take Kandahar and to hunt down and kill as many Taliban and Al-Qaeda with our weapons or with aircraft. And imagine getting to the last set of mountains before the Kandahar airport and getting on top of the mountain and sitting there with a native Pashtun tribal leader who used to live in Kandahar but now lives in Phoenix, Arizona. And he is telling you all the specific things about the area. You're getting eyes on the location. It's flat desert terrain. And then 2 days later, you're dropping bombs. You're looking through scopes and binoculars. You have laser pointers. The aircraft have laser-guided bombs, GPS-guided bombs. One of the aircraft could be an intelligence aircraft who's been orbiting overhead, listening to cell phone conversations, tracking locations of Al-Qaeda, and you're targeting. You're calling the aircraft in hot, which means they can drop their bombs. We did that for about 3 weeks and did over 350 close air support missions. Fighting.
Well, and you're using, at that point, you know, the latest and greatest technology. The guy next to you may have ridden in on his horse, but you're showing up there and commanding and controlling these as a combat controller for the United States Air Force with the latest and greatest technology that you hope is going to work in this high mountain desert place. Did it always work?
No. There were times where it was just terrible tragedies. Not on my team, but my teammate and his team, who was north of Kandahar, they had one mistake. That's all it took, was one mistake out of hundreds of successes. A B-52 bomber came in and dropped a 2,000-pound bomb on their coordinates. And it was an accident using the GPS. One of the teammates switched out the battery and continued to process the mission and didn't realize that the GPS reverted back to his position. And it dropped the bomb right on their position, killing 3 Americans and 8 Afghans. There were times when I have the pilot come in to drop a bomb, and 3 miles away, the bomb would land away from the target. And you'd shake your head. There was a time when, too long of a story now, but we dropped a bomb, and at the last second, after the bomb was released from the aircraft, the Afghan leader was like, "No, no, no, that's our friend." And I was like, "What do you mean that's your friend? You just told me that was Taliban." And the guy survived the bomb.
Yeah, I think again, we get this sanitized version back here in the States as to what,
yes,
how this really works. But anybody up close knows, you know, it's not only brutal, but it's got all kinds of room for error. Let me just remind the veteran radio listeners that we're talking to Andy Kubik, who's a U.S. Air Force veteran, served 15 years, and among other things was awarded the Silver Star for his activity in November of 2001. He was attached to Operational Detachment Alpha, which was attacking north through a valley toward Kandahar, Afghanistan, with a 500-man anti-Taliban force that began a decisive engagement that took quite a long period of time, and there was a withering barrage of anti-aircraft gunfire and rocket grenades that had the team pinned down. As a massive volume of fire rained down on them, stunning the coalition, Staff Sergeant Kubik stayed in an exposed position and calmly coordinated emergency air, close air support with devastating effectiveness. Staff Sergeant Kubik controlled numerous bombing runs that set the conditions for a counterattack by Special Forces team and anti-Taliban force, which led to the battlefield being swept of the enemy forces. Staff Sergeant Kubik's decisive actions were overwhelmingly responsible for breaking the back of the Taliban resistance and cleared the way for the final offensive on Kandahar and subsequent victory in southern Afghanistan. And I'm reading from his Silver Star citation. So Andy's seen it all in theater. Getting out as you did in 2004, so three years or so after that hellacious activity in Afghanistan, the transition back to civilian life was not particularly easy for you, was it, Andy?
No, it wasn't. And as we transition to that, let me emphasize a couple things. That what you just read, that was my second of I'm sorry, that was my fourth of 6 deployments. And I would return to Afghanistan a second time and then do the invasion of Iraq. And my wife at the time, she was also in the Air Force, Special Operations Command. And she deployed and she ended up choosing to leave the Air Force early and take our son and move back with her family in West Virginia, leaving me to do the final deployment to Iraq. And we were separated pretty much from 9/11 until January 2004. And you have to imagine the deployments were... I'm trying to show you how it was so difficult for me personally to transition. The experiences fighting were not regimented. It was a gray world. It was not black and white. It was making decisions, battlefield decisions, command decisions. It wasn't waiting for a commander to tell you what to do. Each of us were making our own decisions and choices. We were working with the latest technology. Some of it we had never used before. We were handed it as we were heading out the door, and we had to figure out how to use it. It was a mind-blowing experience, realizing that we could accomplish so much with so little, and we were responsible for disruption of modern warfare. in real time when you experience that, you either don't realize it or it's so profound that it's mind blowing and you can barely communicate that to others, especially when you get back home. I had to make my decision on whether or not I was going to stay in or leave and return to my family. I made my decision on my final day of my contract at like 4:30 in the afternoon, just as personnel were going home. I decided that I would leave and accept risks, and I was going to make a traditional transition into the CIA and return to the war later. First, I had to get my degree. I started seeing the first signs of PTSD, and that last year away from my family, I was living out of a storage unit because we had our house rented out, and I started abusing a commercial drug to calm my nerves, and I would go on to use that drug for 6 years after I left the military, after a divorce, after I failed out of college and was fired from a couple jobs, had treatment. It would take 7 years before I was treated for substance abuse, and I was given powerful psychotropics and was treated for a wide range of mental health issues versus being treated for substance abuse. I was abusing a hallucinogenic, and I wasn't abusing marijuana or cocaine or any other street drug. And that's what made the problem hard to decipher for doctors. Plus, I wasn't telling them that I was abusing the drug. It was a catastrophe. It wasn't a traditional story of PTSD and struggling. It was bad choices. It was, I couldn't believe that I was such a high functioning individual who had experienced success, had raised a family, a loving wife, and who was my best friend. I had reached a point I was by myself, with my family, my parents, and my siblings struggling to help me. Everything was failing. And I had a 6-year-old son, and he would go on to witness me struggle all the way up until he graduated high school, until it finally stopped. And I left the VA, and off and on, I returned to working for the Special Operations Command with different jobs, never really getting my feet established on the ground. I had success with civilian healthcare, private industry, who were experts with head trauma, brain injuries, and PTSD. In fact, they specialized working with NFL football players in concussion. And that came in 2014. And ever since then, I've been okay, and I've returned to work and rebuilt another life. I have a very close relationship with my son. He also joined the Air Force and is doing the same job that I used to do. He's surrounded by people that I know, and we have a very, very close relationship. He's the reason I ultimately left the military in a time of war, and I don't regret anything. I made bad choices. I shouldn't have abused the drug. Had I not done that, it would have been totally different. I take responsibility. It's very rare for special warfare guys to, they'll abuse alcohol, but they won't typically abuse drugs. And I was an anomaly. Despite that, they've never left my side. So it's a close community.
Well, it really demonstrates it's a family. They haven't let you fall through the cracks.
No.
Although it sounds like at times you were trying to force yourself through the cracks.
Yes.
And yep. I know that you had some hospitalization.
14 dimes.
Yeah. Did you find that the VA wasn't?
Yeah, they weren't ready for. I was the first Afghan Iraqi veteran in the Ann Arbor VA, in the Dayton VA, in the North Carolina VA. The last time they saw an extreme case like mine was Vietnam.
And it sounds like that through the service you had some traumatic brain injury situations, but you found a civilian healthcare provider that kind of specialized in that area?
Yes, and I want to say their name if that's okay.
Go right ahead, Andy.
Yeah, it's the Eisenhower Center in Ann Arbor. I found this through the Special Operations Command, and they have a ranch out by Chelsea, Michigan, that houses former NFL players and typically special operations warriors.
Yeah, we're familiar with Eisenhower and Camp Liberty out there. They do great work, and we're glad you were able to mention them specifically.
Yes.
As those bad choices led you down one path, it took years, maybe it's 10 years or something to kind of get back on the right path, but you got some education in. I found a book that you wrote, The Art of 21st Century Warfare, talking about how warfare today is more surgical. You kind of got yourself back on the right path the same way probably you made yourself a combat controller, just sort of one step at a time, it sounds like.
Yes. Yeah, I appreciate that. Yep.
And the fact that your son has joined the Air Force, we often ask this question, but I think this already answers it. We often ask veterans, looking back, you know, if you had a son, a daughter, a niece, a nephew, a neighbor's kid who is saying, do you think I should get in, you know, join the military, what would you say?
Oh, I support them 110%. I can't live that life and have all those successes and failures, the amazing experience, and not share that or support someone else. I got equal experience as going to an Ivy League university. It's hard to put into words. I'd support them 110%.
Well, let's tell
everything's dangerous in their own way.
Oh, absolutely. Let's tell people today what you're doing for Air Force Special Warfare.
I am a field developer working alongside Special Warfare Recruiting, helping select, train, and develop candidates who want to try out for the same work that I had done. And I represent Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio.
And are these candidates already in the service or thinking about getting involved, Andy?
They're thinking about joining, and they're typically in high school, but also college.
And if somebody says, you know what, that level of adventure and patriotism and hard work is something, is a challenge I want to take on, How do they get in touch with a field development recruiter like you?
They go through a typical Air Force recruiter who will immediately direct them to the local special warfare recruiter. Every state has a special warfare recruiter.
Now, let's clear this up because you explained it to me earlier, and I don't think we've mentioned it on the air. Special Operations Command in the Air Force is what you were a part of back, a decade or more ago. It's now changed its name. Is that right?
It's still known as Special Operations Command, but they have changed from being known as Special Operations to Special Warfare.
Okay, great. I just wanted people to understand the right language as we go forward here. Andy, we really appreciate you taking time today talking to Veterans Radio, and certainly Andy Kubik, the service that you've performed for the nation and continue to perform for this great nation cannot be simply, we can't thank you enough, and awards and medals don't do that either. We realize how difficult post-service is for a lot of guys, whether it's because they made bad choices or because, you know, their state of mind coming out of service lend them to make bad choices. We're always thrilled when we hear a story like yours that says, "Hey, this is how I got myself out of it, and what I'm doing today." So, Andy, thanks for taking some time with Veterans Radio.
Hey, Jim, thank you very much, and my family appreciates those kind words. One last thought: there's going to be an experience of mourning and grieving. That's what they rarely talk about. Give those your listeners a heads up if they're in the same shoes. And that can be easily dealt with.
Oh, absolutely. You have to give somebody time to do that. And I think you also have to recognize that having a purpose is so important. And for you, it was the son and trying to be the father you wanted to be and the family that you wanted to create. And I think sometimes guys don't get off the couch and get moving because they kind of lost that purpose. They really do need that purpose, don't they?
Yes, definitely.
Again, Andy, thank you for taking time with Veterans Radio.
All right. Take care, Jim.
These are the type of young men who protect this country and for which we should be so grateful. Two real warriors who laid it on the line, injured, and came back to continue building their life. So we want to thank them, both Nick and Andy's, for talking to Veterans Radio. We want to thank you for listening in. You can find more at veteransradio.net. Check us out on Facebook, listen to our podcasts, and come on back next week when Dale Thronberry will be back on. And until next time, you are dismissed.